From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the swastika. And even saying the word is gross, but saying it, that hooked cross, it's really just too much. But the swastika didn't always stand for genocide and hate. Stephen Heller, the former art director at the New York Times, is joining us in the program to talk about the history and the power of the swastika and whether we'll ever be able to reclaim it from the Nazis. After this.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening. And enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Stephen Heller feels like the rest of us when we see a swastika, that gut reaction that makes you cringe. But he admits he can't always look away. He says he's continually drawn to it. And part of it is because he writes about and he critiques graphic design. And there really isn't a symbol that's more powerful. The other part that interests him is how the meaning of the swastika has completely transformed. It used to symbolize good fortune and light and forked lightning and water. You could find it on every continent, in almost every civilization. It had spiritual significance, so you found it engraved in altars and woven into rugs. It was a design feature that meant well-being, so the Boy Scouts used it. Coca-Cola used it. But now, forget about it. Now, when most of us see it, all we can think about is Nazi pageantry and atrocity. But here's one of the questions Stephen Heller asks in his book, The Swastika, Symbol Beyond Redemption. Can the swastika ever be seen in its original context again? Today in the program, we're talking with Stephen Heller. He's a graphic designer and the co-founder and co-chair of the MFA Design, Designer as Author and Entrepreneur program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. He joined us from a studio in New York. Let's first address just how much of a, I guess, how much of a taboo this symbol is. You write in your book that you had considered publishing it yourself because you had been turned down a bit by some publishers. Talk a little bit about that. What was their general reaction before you finally did find someone who was willing to publish the book?
Well, I tried a few mainstream publishers, and basically their response was the public doesn't want to know about the swastika because of its evil connotations. The interesting part of that is that the swastika has been used in mainstream publishing ever since the war ended to sell thrillers and spy novels and other sometimes lascivious works. Mm-hmm. So a history of the swastika was more or less considered not very saleable. The publisher that did it, Allworth Press, is one that's published a lot of my books on graphic design and popular culture. And then actually a year later, I found out that Harry Abrams would have published the book. They're a big art book publisher. So while there is a taboo in terms of a kind of initial knee-jerk reaction to it, those taboos are not locked in stone.
Yeah. You write about how the first time you encountered a Nazi flag was when you, I think you were eight. A friend gave you a flag.
Yeah, my cousin actually gave me a flag that his father had brought back from the war, from Europe, World War II. And he had kept it with other souvenirs in his home. And we pulled it out of the drawer and started waving it around the house. It wasn't a very propitious time. I think it was during Passover. And we were reprimanded for doing so. But we had no real idea of the power or the meaning of the flag, because in the post-war years, in the 50s, the Holocaust was not something that was talked about, particularly in Jewish families.
Yeah. You write about, as a designer, being fascinated by the swastika as a symbol. As a Jew, being embarrassed by that fascination, too. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very powerful symbol, and anybody who is graphically minded, as I was at a young age and certainly in my adulthood, you can't help but be attracted to this sign. It's a geometric, pure image, the four hooked legs, or it's called a Hakenkreuz, a hooked cross. So I was interested in it as a logo, a piece of graphics. I was interested in how it was used for uniforms and other militaria. I had gone to a military school myself, so it was kind of in my head. And at the same time, by the time I was in my preteens and certainly in my teens, I understood the negativity of it all, how it was still being used to represent some horrible things, and how it affected my own family and the families of others that I knew.
It's interesting. Let's set aside for just a moment, although that may be ultimately impossible, which we'll get to, but let's just for a moment try to set aside the horrible and brutal history of the swastika. What is it that is compelling or potent about it as a form? You mentioned its kind of geometric purity. What else about it is so potent and so powerful? It's legible, you say? It's dynamic?
Well, it's legible, it's dynamic. I say in the book that it's kind of like a propeller of an aeroplane, and for some reason, and I can't really be that articulate about it, but for some reason, propellers are very striking images. There's a power to them. Even if you look at a fan and you see those three or sometimes four propellers in motion, there is some sort of thrill that you get. And the swastika, certainly on its angle, which is what the Nazis did with it, gives it that strength. And I'm saying it's a kind of indescribable strength. It's more of an emotional response than it is an intellectual one.
Do you think it's the most powerful, or certainly one of the most powerful symbols that you know of?
I think it's up there as one of the three, four, or five most powerful symbols, and I would argue that it's as powerful as the crucifix.
Yeah.
That the swastika and the crucifix have an equal graphic strength, an equal symbolic strength, albeit not the same ultimate message, but the crucifix began as a symbol of torture, of execution. Mm-hmm. And the swastika began as a symbol of fertility and good luck. So they were kind of switched at birth.
Yeah. You say in your book, The Swastika, that human beings have always imbued graphic symbols with a kind of power, and that symbols are kind of a way of reflecting, I guess, the deepest facets of our existence, like our innermost beliefs is how you put it. Would you talk a little bit about that, how symbols come to have that kind of power?
Well, symbols are a shorthand for a lot of things that we see, feel, emote. They are representations of behavior, of belief, of faith, of lack of faith. And so I think they've become powerful to us because of those representations. I mean, I've always talked about logos, and that's what the swastika is. It's a logo, and it's a brand. It may represent something, but it only is as good or as powerful as what it is that it represents. The swastika has the shape, it has the form, but its representation is what makes it good, bad, or indifferent. And I think we respond to it as human beings because of that history that of behavior and of that meaning.
And the remarkable ones live forever, I guess.
The remarkable ones live forever. I mean, you can, and I have in a book called Iron Fists, Branding the 20th Century Totalitarian State, I've equated the world's fascist and communist symbols to branding devices. So in a sense, I'm saying that the swastika or the fasci or the hammer and sickle or the Chinese star is no different than IBM, M&M's, Coca-Cola, or whatever other well-known brand mark there are.
Where do we get the word swastika? Let's go back and talk about the history here. Where does the word come from that we know?
Well, the swastika, the word is Sanskrit. There are many ways of describing the swastika. There's something called the flyfot. There's the Hakenkreuz, as I mentioned. There's the savastika, which is a swastika turned the other way. There are probably other names that have been used. In Sanskrit, it represents good fortune. So it doesn't. It is not a term that was originated by the Germans, although Hakenkreuz was.
Right.
And they can be interchanged.
It was a sign of benediction, we think, at some point?
Well, there are so many ways of describing it that the Smithsonian Museum in the late 1890s published a book that shows the swastika on all continents in many countries, both pagan and primitive, where swastikas have been found, and their representation is everything from fertility to four seasons to luck and good luck and fortune and magic and things that are spiritual and things that are divine.
What do you think, what do you imagine that it meant for the people who first conceived of it? That you write about one particular anthropologist who figured that the swastika was in some ways such a simple form that it was it could have been used by, you know, primitive humans to mean whatever they figured it could mean.
Well, before I answer that question, the swastika comes in many different forms.
Yeah.
There are curved swastikas. There are swastikas that are angular. There are other symbols that are like swastikas that have only 3 feet. In fact, in Sicily, there's an image that uses a similar configuration, but only 3 feet instead of 4 feet. What it meant to those peoples, it meant different things.
Yeah.
When my book, Swastika, a Symbol Beyond Redemption, came out, the first letter that I received was from a Native American who actually took me to task for what he called cultural colonialism, for using, for saying basically that the swastika was beyond redemption, when in fact it belonged to his people, it belonged to so many other people. So he saw it as a very positive spiritual marking that was used on grave sites and other places. In the Far East, in the Middle East, it also appears. It's the on the foot of Buddha. So people who embrace the swastika embraced it for different reasons. How it came about is still, for me, a mystery.
Yeah. It's so interesting that, as you say, it has appeared in both hemispheres and pretty much every continent and most every country, although not everywhere, and we can get back to that. But there's some Isn't there some idea that the model for the swastika then, because it appears everywhere, might have been some kind of well-known or useful kind of device?
Well, there was some notion that it was used as a barometric pressure device. And where it was through the middle, a hole was drilled or dug out or whatever, and it kind of leaned according to the pressure in the air. So it may have had a functional purpose as well as a symbolic purpose. In more recent times, it's been – I've seen it used as fireworks, mm-hmm. the shape of fireworks in terms of a swastika, a twirling device. I've seen it as pastry. I've seen it made out of petals, flower petals. There are so many different ways of seeing it that it would boggle your mind to think that it is only known for its evilness and criminality.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so extraordinary about it. And we'll get to this, what I think is kind of the crucial question, at least now, is can we ever see it in that original context again, given what happened. But we'll get back to that. I want to ask you about the fact that it was on, as you say in your book, coins and vases and pottery. It was in Native American sites in North America. It was found in stone pedestals and altars and, I mean, pretty much everywhere.
Well, the most significant finding of the swastika, at least for the swastikalists like myself,
yeah.
Happened in the city of Troy. Heinrich Schliemann, the archaeologist, found it on pottery that he located in the dig at Troy. And for the people of the late 19th century, early 20th century, that was as big a deal, as big a prospect as landing on the moon, you know, finding these lost cities of planet Earth and finding that they had symbols that kind of transported through time. And the swastika became this this icon for many people. Some were cultists. Some were more rational individuals. But it represented earlier cultures, not necessarily primitive cultures, but earlier civilizations.
Schliemann was obsessed with the symbol, you say.
He was so obsessed with the symbol that apparently his home was decorated with many of them. But for that matter, the swastika was part of Rudyard Kipling's own ex libris. The swastika was used by the Boy Scouts, by the Girls Club, by Coca-Cola, by scores of manufacturing concerns. If you look through trademark annuals in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere, you'll find that the swastika was used often and registered as a trademark for particular companies, but never really was owned by any one company, that it was the most public domain image of all. And I doubt you would find that there's anybody now who wants to lay claim to its registration or copyright.
When you look at some of the photos in your book, for example, you see some of the commercial applications of it. Like the Coca-Cola one is surprising. In the modern context, it's hard to really know what to make of that. But it seems like that symbol was kind of like a peace symbol almost in the early 20th century. It evoked pleasant thoughts and nice ideas, I think, it seems.
It was a calming symbol.
Yeah.
Peace symbol, perhaps, definitely good luck and good fortune. And it appeared on many greeting cards, postcards, sheet music. I remember one called The Swastika Vals. It appears, in fact, you can look online and you'll find a laundry either in London or Dublin called the Swastika Laundry.
Yeah. That van was red.
That van was red, and the swastika, I believe, was in a white circle.
It was in black.
Right, and you'd find it on as the marking for the Finnish Air Force. Yeah. You'd find it as a marking in gold against red for a United States Expeditionary Force that later became known as the Thunderbird Division, and it represented the four states in the American West that division was made up of. So the symbolic value of the swastika was that four units had come together to make one expeditionary battalion, brigade, or army.
Do you think that throughout the country, maybe even throughout the world right now, there are foot lockers and cedar chests full of this stuff that no one dares bring out, that wonders, you know, wondering why grandpa or great grandpa had such a thing?
Well, not only do I know that it exists, I've seen it many times. A friend of mine, for example, who lives in Brooklyn, bought a house that is circa 1920, and they have parquet floors, and the border around the floor in beautifully shined wood are swastikas linked together. The Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York has swastika decoration around the side of one of the older buildings. If you look in typography books, type books that were given to printers, you'll find linked swastikas. It was used as a decorative architectural printing device.
There is some reason to believe that it didn't actually appear everywhere necessarily. It wasn't in ancient Egypt, I guess. Ancient Palestine, it wasn't there, we don't think, or Assyria either. The Jews, we don't think, used it.
I'm not sure. I know that it was in a synagogue or two. There was one in New York where it was sandblasted out. It's appeared in religious institutions. I got a call a number of years ago from one somewhere in New England that was debating whether to get rid of theirs. There's a town in Canada called Swastika. There was recently a story in the BBC website about a swastika that was on an anchor that the town that was using the anchor as a monument refused to obliterate because they felt it had nothing to do with the Nazi ideology. So it may not be everywhere in the world, but it's certainly in a lot of places and maybe even most places.
When someone calls you and says, we're a church, we have these Nazi symbols in our in the flooring, what should we do? What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them, first of all, they're not Nazi symbols.
Right.
If they were made before 1921, they represent something altogether different. If they are concerned about them, it's better to cover them up than foster a debate about them. But at the same time, and one of the reasons for doing the book is that it really should be addressed. It should be discussed, if only to understand the power of symbols and symbology. But, you know, we have not seen the end of the swastika as representing something evil and misanthropic and racist.
Stephen Heller. He's a graphic designer, lecturer, and the author of a number of books about graphic design, including this one, The Swastika, Symbol Beyond Redemption. There's a question mark there in the title. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the swastika. Our guest is Stephen Heller, former longtime art director with the New York Times, who has written about the history and the power of the swastika and whether we'll ever be able to reclaim it from Nazis and racists. It seems like when you're talking about there have been these efforts to redeem the swastika. Artists do this from time to time and others. And religious figures who want to reclaim a figure that they feel like they have some ownership with or trying to reclaim it. But it seems like just when you're getting to the point when maybe that conversation could be had, something like Charlottesville happens. It seems like those kinds of things are always going to emerge, and this idea of trying to redeem or reclaim the swastika is going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
Well, I am of two minds, and that's the problem with being a liberal, of having two minds about something. It's much better to be fanatically opposed to something. I had a student once, and probably more than once, but one who was very demonstrative about when I gave a lecture on the swastika, of his telling me he was a Buddhist, that for him the swastika, not necessarily in the black version but in a green version, was very important to him from a spiritual point of view. And the week after I gave the lecture, I came to the class, he had over his workstation a huge white swastika on a green background. Now, was he thumbing his nose at me, or was he just showing that there are other points of view? Doesn't really matter. Yeah. There are other points of view about this. And there are people who really feel, in a fanatical way, let's say, that the swastika has great healing and spiritual powers, and that it was co-opted for 12 years at its height of depravity, and that it should be given back to its rightful owners. And I sympathize with that. And so when I wrote the book, redemption comes with a question mark.
Right.
I think that it's a very difficult issue. So, yes, when you have something like Charlottesville and you have other white supremacist nationalist movements around the country and they use the swastika, it's hard to say it will ever be redeemed by generations that forget the Nazi Party and what they did, because those issues just keep arising and arising. And despite the warmth that those supremacists were shown by our own president, I don't even think he'd wear a swastika.
What's so fascinating also about this story is how the transformation that you work through in the book, this metamorphosis of this symbol from something that represents, you know, good fortune and fertility to this emblem of hate. So let's talk a little bit about when the Germans acquire the swastika. We think that the Germans started using it somewhere around the Bronze period. It was an ornament mostly, I guess, at first.
It was an ornament, but really what happens in the late 19th century is it's uncovered and it becomes this powerful symbol that is basically embraced by a bunch of different groups.
Yeah.
And one of those larger manifestations are racialists in Germany and Austria. And there was a man named Guido von Liszt, who was a philosopher, poet, come racialist, who believed that it represented an Aryan race of super beings, which came out of an Indo-European background. Mm-hmm. And so he created a mythology for it that was followed by many young people.
It was like kind of like King Arthur for the Britons in some ways?
Well, it was – I equate it more to the Ankh, huh. The Egyptian Ankh during the hippie period.
Yeah.
When there was this symbol that somehow represented a spiritualism that went beyond the materialism of the age. And what often happens after there's a great period of – in our case, capitalism and periods of greed, there is always a reaction to that. And you stumble on to things that kind of support that reaction. And the Ankh was one of those in the hippie period, as was the peace sign, which is also an ancient symbol that was repurposed.
Yeah.
The swastika
basically is... is used as a counter to what kind of the materialism of the modern age of that time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
The swastika was – there were many different kind of back-to-nature groups, if you want to call them that, festivals and the like where people would dance around the swastika or dance with swastika ephemera, wear swastika pins. And again, it didn't have the ideological manifestation, but it was a spiritual one that kind of led to an ideological one.
Yeah.
Ultimately, in Germany, it was adopted by the Germanen Order. It was the logo for a publication called Ostara, which Hitler apparently read. It was the symbol for white Aryanism. For a superior race. It got convoluted and contorted. It was used after World War I by German nationalists called the Stahlhelm or Steel Helmet, which led directly and indirectly into the Nazi Party.
Do we know when Adolf Hitler first encounters the symbol?
Well, we assume it's around 1920, 1921. If he was a reader of Ostara when he was in Vienna, it might have been in the teens. If he was aware of the racialist orders, it might have been even earlier than the teens. But when he becomes the propaganda minister of the Nazi Party or the German Workers' Party at the time, he determines that it's important for the Nazis to have a symbol that was as powerful and as rallying as the hammer and sickle was for their natural enemies, the communists.
Yeah. He had been to this communist rally, and he was pretty impressed by the flags and the scarves and things.
He was at a lot of rallies because they had a lot of street brawls.
Right.
So, yes, he was impressed by their graphical presence. There's a wonderful movie that came out a number of years ago called Max with John Cusack as this Jewish art dealer who a young Adolf Hitler just out of the war comes to see to sell his drawings because Hitler was an artist.
Right.
And the character played by Cusack says, your work is just too realistic. It's too turgid. Why don't you do something that you really feel for? And in one scene, you see him creating the symbols that will become the symbols of Nazi Germany. It's a little overly dramatized, mm-hmm. but it goes without saying that in a sense, the Nazi Party and all of its regalia was kind of an art project for this budding but failed artist.
Who decides to tilted. When do we get the kind of iconic Nazi swastika?
Well, apparently, if you are to read Mein Kampf, Hitler's major drone, but best-selling drone, he has a section in there which reads very much like a graphic designer wrote it, about the colors and why the colors were chosen and the symbol and how he opened up a competition to members of the party to come up with a symbol of the swastika. And there was somebody who he describes as a dentist from Darmstadt, Germany.
Doesn't even name him.
I don't think he names him. I don't remember. But he says that he had the same idea to use the swastika, again, because it was part of this nationalist liturgy of symbols. But Hitler took it one step further.
Yeah.
He put it in the circle, the white circle representing the white of purity, against the blood red background, and made it black and tilted it and gave it its direction. So Hitler takes credit for slanting it. Whether he did or not, I'm not sure. Yeah. There were swastikas in use. There was a man named Wilhelm Defke who designed a swastika, which he was a graphic designer, and the swastika was being used. It was perfectly square. It wasn't at a tilt. Wilhelm Defke, in a letter to another graphic designer who I've written about, Paul Rand, said that the German Nazis took his swastika and never paid him for it. But these are all apocryphal stories.
It only took a few years, though, you say, for the swastika to transform itself from an occult talisman, you say, to a national icon. And then it was settled, I suppose, by what? Probably in the late 20s?
Well, it became a talisman and became a party symbol.
Yeah.
And it was a party symbol until 1933. And there's a difference between a national symbol and a party symbol, obviously.
Yeah.
We don't salute the Democratic donkey or the Republican elephant. And although Nazis wore their swastikas proudly, it was not the symbol of Germany until 1933 or 1934, when the Reichstag, which was then dominated by the Nazis, officially proclaimed it to be the national symbol and the national flag, and created laws and decrees that protected it from commercial usage, from any kind of distorted usage, and kept it from being used by anyone of the Jewish persuasion.
It's interesting. There's this part in the book where you write about, you mention, I think it's Malcolm Quinn, who talked about how Adolf Hitler and the swastika came to be seen as kind of interchangeable. Like if you look at Triumph of the Will, that, you know, German propaganda film, that whenever Hitler's not there, his place is taken by the swastika.
Yeah, the swastika became Hitler. Hitler was the trade character, let's call him. You know, I joke, but it's quite true. He was the Mr. Clean or the Cheeto Bandito or, you know, the Jolly Green Giant of the party. And the symbol was, if we're talking Jolly Green Giant and Bird's Eye, it was the bird up in the corner of the box. So the symbol and Hitler were one in the same. Because Hitler took credit for it, it became even more of a personal emblem that was then loaned to the rest of Germany.
Explain, Stephen Heller, what happens after the war. It's so interesting. You see this attempt to basically hide the Nazi swastika and this Nazi Reichstag art, quote-unquote, from view.
Well, what's interesting, and you've probably seen this and many people have as well, there's a clip of film that leads off the film The Judgment at Nuremberg, and it's also in many documentaries, of the Nuremberg Stadium. And there's a swastika in the middle of a circular laurel, and it's being dynamited off the top of the balcony at Nuremberg. And that is truly symbolic of how the Allies felt the Nazi image had to be destroyed. And so the German government's ultimately, the Allies and the Soviets banned, whether they truly outlawed or not is another story, but they banned the use of the swastika as a public emblem because they felt it had such symbolic power, it could ignite the flame of fascism again.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go to flea markets in Germany, in Berlin, you'll see that Nazi symbols like the swastika, the symbol of Grosse Deutschland, which is the eagle with the swastika in its talons, and even the SS runes are usually blocked out with magic marker or with tape, even though the elements, the artifacts, are still sold or were sold as souvenirs.
At what point does the swastika then kind of reemerge and start being used as, you know, graffiti and then symbols of racism and hate?
Well, I think the swastika was reemerged almost immediately.
Yeah.
Just as the hammer and sickle or the letters KPD for the German Communist Party or the V for victory were graffitied all over Berlin and other German cities. In fact, there were units that would go out at night and paint over all of the graffiti, the anti-Nazi graffiti that was placed on these structures, these buildings, and wherever. You'd see supporters of the Nazis using swastikas. They would use them as weapons against Jewish places of worship or cemeteries, and they still are. So the swastika never really went away. It went away from public life in terms of seeing it as a piece of jewelry or a piece of architectural decoration. But even in that case, in recent years, there have been swastika uses that have popped up as in as innocuous places as Pokemon cards.
Yeah.
But they represent other cultures.
You yourself point out in the book that there are symbols that had been used for atrocities. The cross, the star, the crescent, but they managed to be redeemed over time. Why is the swastika different, if it is?
Well, let me just add, the cross, the crescent, and the star have gone back ages.
Yeah.
But the fasci, which was used by the Italian fascists, we used it as well in the United States and still use it in the halls of Congress. The hammer and sickle is used as a piece of kitsch. The Japanese battle flag is still used as a beautiful design. So there are an awful lot of signs and symbols that have been used for terrible things that are still used.
I can't tell you how many Che Guevara T-shirts I see.
Yeah, Che became a fashion symbol.
Yeah.
Just as the peace symbol is an upside-down cross or crow's foot. Mm-hmm. That was re-co-opted for peace rather than death. Although you can still say it's a sign of death because without peace, there's the alternative is war. Things get reimagined and reused for a lot of different reasons. But the swastika, because it was such a profound crime against humanity and represented such a profound and terribly heartless group of people, somehow didn't make it through the filter.
Yeah.
It wasn't the worst Holocaust in the world. There were many people who were killed in other genocides and have been killed in other genocides. But this is the one where the symbol stuck.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could come up with all sorts of theories as to why. But ultimately, the theories don't really mean anything. It's this is the Holocaust. This is the devastation. This is the racial cleansing that we all remember through at least my generation, which is the baby boomer generation. And thanks to things like Charlottesville and other demonstrations of white nationalism or nationalism all over Europe now, it's come back again.
Yeah. You're right. It's not just a vessel that can be emptied out at will, because it's not just any vessel. So I wonder, when you see or hear about monks who are carrying bags with swastika symbols on them being harassed and things like that, you must think that that's kind of a shame. So it sounds like you're not against, maybe I'm wrong about this, but you're not necessarily against redeeming the symbol. You just think it can't be done, or maybe even shouldn't be done.
Well, I go back and forth.
Yeah. You're a liberal again, right?
I'm a liberal again. I go back and forth that, you know, a symbol is innocent until proven guilty. And it's proven guilty by what it stands for. And you know, if those monks are carrying swastikas, and if you go to Southeast Asia, you will get a swastika. I mean, there are peel-off swastikas that you get if you go into a Thai temple.
Yeah.
Somebody once called them swastikis. you know, you get a swastika pastry if you go to some places. It's these things have different meanings. But if you're here in the United States, or if you're in Europe, there are very few alternatives for the swastika in terms of rightness and wrongness. The swastika is wrong. The swastika is bad. If you're in the United States, it's very difficult to look at the swastika and think that it's not being used for some nefarious purpose.
You, this may surprise some people, but you have a collection of swastika artifacts. Do you still have it, by the way?
I still have it. I've donated a lot of my totalitarian materials to the Wolfsonian Museum in Miami, which is also dubbed the Museum of Decorative and Propaganda Arts, which seems like an oxymoron. But in fact, it's a really amazing collection of things that do deal with propaganda from around the world up until 1945, sometimes beyond. I gave them a large collection, but I kept my documentation on the swastika because I figured there's going to be something coming again. Mm. And, you know, I hate to be pessimistic, but it's my nature. So I was kind of proven right, since I get a lot of calls these days about the swastika.
You say, have written that you began researching the origins of the swastika as a symbol, in part because you were trying to figure out why that symbol had such a, and I'll use your word, hypnotic force for you. Do you think you figured that out now?
To be honest, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it is still a hypnotic force. There are still things that I will purchase, and I'll purchase it as a historian rather than a fan. But I'm attracted to this for reasons that I can only say was intended by its makers. There is something very odd about how the Nazis were able to tie a people together, and not just Germans, but other Eastern Europeans and people who supported that kind of ideology. And it's always troubled me, but it's also fascinated me that people could become so sheep-like and so ready and willing to believe in propaganda. So for me, the overall concern, the overall interest, and the overall fascination is the power of propaganda. The symbol is one major part of that, but not the entire thing.
Stephen Heller. He's the author of a number of books on graphic design, including the one we were talking about, The Swastika Symbol Beyond Redemption. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.